The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go? We have Mr. Walter Cruttenton, and it's partially because of Walter this show exists. He was the first person to do an interview with us in any way, shape, or form. That was on our show that follows this, The Last Exit for the Lost. And he is the author of a book called The Lost Star of Myth and Time, and he has a documentary out on it. He's the founder of the Binary Research Institute. He is runs the CPAC conference. And can you hear me, Walter?
I sure can.
Did I get everything there?
I think you got most of it. We'll fill in as we go along.
All right. And when did this book come out?
Lost Star of Myth and Time came out around 2005, 2006. And then we had the film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones, and that sort of picks up on the story a little bit a few years later. And then most recently, The Great Year Adventures with Tommy the Time Traveling Turtle, sort of a kid's view of this whole thing, because everyone had been asking me to break it down to real simple terms, and so we got it real simple there in the latest book.
That's great. And you founded the Binary Research Institute, right?
Yes, yeah, that started first back in 2001, and it was really, you know, I'd long been curious about the cause and consequences of solar system motion and this whole idea of precession. And we did some very serious work there for quite a number of years, you know, had astrophysicists and mathematicians on staff, and had a pretty good crew. And that basically, that research served as the basis for the book, Lost Star of Myth and Time.
Okay. And are you still doing the CPAC conferences? I know you did one last year. You're not doing it this year, are you?
We're taking a break. Yeah, we've done it 8 years in a row, and just thought we'd take a break. But we've already made arrangements to do it in 2014. That'll be at the Westin Rancho Mirage in October of 2014.
Okay. What state is that in?
Oh, that's down in Rancho Mirage, California.
Okay.
Yeah, beautiful part of the desert. Great time of the year to visit, too, because the season, it hasn't gotten cold enough for everyone to come there, and it's the desert is just gorgeous when it's still hot and empty.
Hmm. Okay. So what got you into this field of study in the first place?
You know, I'd always been interested in history as a little boy. You know, my mom used to buy me books about ancient cultures, ancient cities, and I was just fascinated with how advanced some of them were. Mesopotamia, Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, you know, they had knowledge of mathematics, astronomy, medicine. They had indoor plumbing and heating and canals and sewer systems, things like this, you know, thousands of years before Western Europe. Same thing in the Indus Valley, Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa. They built with uniform bricks and again, indoor plumbing and heating and baths and things like this. And these civilizations all went away, as did Greece and Rome and Egypt. And, you know, many of them seem to go backwards as we move towards the Dark Ages. So it nagged me a little bit that when we got into school, that, you know, they teach you that evolution is fairly linear, and that anything that came before us must be more primitive. And I just wasn't seeing that, and I didn't think much about it, you know, as I finished school and started early in business, and then finally came across a book called The Holy Science by Swami Sri Yukteswar, and he's a Indian sage, saint, also quite an astronomer. And he mentioned almost just in passing in the introduction of one of his books that there's these cycles of history. And he was the first guy I ever read that gave a cause for it. And he said, you know, just as the earth spins on its axis and that gives you night and day because we face the sun or turn away from it, and that causes our consciousness to change from, you know, a waking state during the day to subconscious at night when our bodies are adapted better for sleep. And just as the earth goes around the sun and causes the cycle of the seasons and billions of life forms to migrate, spawn, hibernate, or, you know, do all sorts of things in mass, likewise, there's a third motion of the whole solar system moving around another star. And so it was a very short explanation, but it made a lot of logical sense to me. And he said it was this larger motion that caused the rise and fall of civilization. And that was just sort of a precursor in the introduction to understanding, you know, why consciousness is relatively low at this point in time. And I thought it made sense, and so we did a lot of serious research on this, as I mentioned, about 10, 15 years ago.
Okay, and these cycles are personified in the great year of the Greeks.
Yeah, Plato called it the great year and broke it down into the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. The Indians called it the Yugas, but the Mayans call it different suns. The Hopis call it different worlds. There's about at least 30, some say closer to 40 ancient cultures that spoke of this cycle, this rise and fall of the ages. And of course, you know, today we're taught that, oh, it's just a myth. But it's so widely prevalent in these ancient cultures, many of which are totally unconnected, you know, Nordic to Polynesian to Egyptian to, you know, Western indigenous cultures, that you got to think that there's something to it. And indeed, we think there is something to it.
Okay. And now, a lot of these time scales also match up to our time for precession, correct?
Right. Yeah. So just as, you know, our time scale for a complete day and night is one rotation of the earth, and or a complete year is, you know, one revolution of the earth around the sun, relative to a fixed star. So it is with precession. You know, this cycle is generally said in myth and folklore to move with one precession, the equinox. And that is a very slow motion. You know, that takes roughly 24 to 26,000 years. And the reason for the range is that the rate of precession changes slightly over long periods of time. And so, yeah, it's roughly 12,000 years of, you know, things getting better, 12,000 years of things getting worse. And in fact, our daily system of time with 12 hours of AM where you're getting more light and 12 hours of PM where you're getting more darkness is like a little microcosm of this great year, as Plato called it.
Okay. Now, there's two different versions of how long the Yuga cycle is in India, correct? There's the more traditional one, which goes on for millions of years, and this is the one you're talking about, which goes on for about 24,000.
Yes. And there may well be longer cycles. You know, if the 24-hour day is due to an Earth rotation and the 365-day year is due to one revolution of the Earth around the sun, and the great year is, you know, one precession cycle when we return back to the same stellar alignment on the equinox, it may be that, you know, the whole binary system or stellar system, if you will, kind of has an even larger movement. The whole stellar neighborhood moves around.
Okay. Well, but the 24,000-year cycle of Yugas is not generally accepted, is it?
You know, that's a good question. I think what it is misinterpreted. Those that really study the matter tend to accept that there is this cycle, and there may well indeed be longer cycles, the universal cycle. And there are many people in traditional India that call those different names.
Mm, okay.
And they do call the longer one the Yuga cycle. And because, you know, we call the precessionary cycle the Yuga cycle also, it does get very confusing.
I see. All right. And as you started studying this, what did you find as being the cause of these cycles?
Oh, you know, I think I have a hypothesis.
Right.
I'm not certain.
That's what I mean. I know you're not certain about anything.
Right, exactly. Good. All right. So just as the there's a change in consciousness every day relative to the Earth's rotation relative to the sun, and it seems to be caused by light. You know, there's an increase in light, and our body's adapted to it, and things grow during the light. Photosynthesis occurs, blah, blah, blah. And when we go away from the light, things slow down, et cetera. And same thing during the year, when you get more photons per square inch, you know, of the electromagnetic spectrum of the sun hitting the Earth, you know, things grow and you have spring and it activates this whole cycle of nature. And when there's less light, it seems to go in reverse. Likewise, we believe that it's some sort of stellar light, if you will. And, you know, we use this common nomenclature of light, but it's really a broad electromagnetic spectrum, and visible light is, you know, just one fraction of it, but it includes, you know, everything from ultraviolet to infrared, and there's gamma rays, radio waves, microwaves, all sorts of stuff in there. And so we think that it's the effect of this this electromagnetic spectrum in some way that affects life over a very long period of time, just as our sun in relation and our Earth are affected in these shorter cycles.
Okay.
There's a neat body of work on that. I think I might have mentioned last time the work of Dr. Valerie Hunt at UCLA, and where she actually put subjects in a Faraday cage. They called it the Mu Room at UCLA, where she was a physiologist professor. And she noticed that when people are in this cage, and she gave them tests to do, and this cage has all sorts of insulation, different metals that pretty much cancel out most of the ambient EM that we live in and we depend on, you know, for life.
Mm-hmm.
And when people are in it for too long a period of time, they get sort of freaked out, and their bodies would often react poorly, and they would cry and didn't know why they were crying, and different symptoms like this. And yet there's another part of the spectrum, you know, if you actually turn up things like negative ions, people feel really good. And so it could be that this, you know, these subtle energies that we really don't understand very well, but we do know that they have certain effects on us, you know, like SAD, seasonal affective disorder, affects many people when they're away from light for too long a period of time, that it's has something to do with this, and it's probably occurring over very long periods of time. And that's maybe influencing what we call dark ages and golden ages on the planet Earth.
Okay. I know Robert Schock did some work on psychic abilities, showing that when the sun was more active, people were more likely to have psychic ability than when it wasn't, which shows a sort of connection to the sun cycles that you wouldn't think would be there.
Yeah, I really like Dr. Schock's work. You know, he's a tenured professor, and yet he's not afraid to, you know, sort of do some research in some areas where traditionalists might scoff at him.
Right, yeah.
Great guy.
He's not afraid to stick his neck out. He's been on your CPAC conference a bunch of times, hasn't he?
Yeah, he comes there, and he'll go out on a limb and he'll saw it off.
Okay, so... So basically what you're saying is that celestial influences are what are happening to us throughout time that are causing this rise and fall.
I think so. Yeah, I really do. And, you know, there's many ancient cultures were just absolutely fascinated by the stars and this whole astronomy of, or science of astrology, which sort of morphed into astronomy in the more modern material ages, indicates that they were, you know, almost trying to figure out and study the influences from the planets and the stars. But of course, the way it's, you know, passed down through the Dark Ages and everything, I think it's not very well understood nowadays. And in fact, even though astronomy came from astrology, many astronomers now just completely dismiss astrology as having, you know, no basis whatsoever. But I think that'll flip as we learn more and more.
Well, and two, so much astrology is just pop culture at this point. It doesn't really seem to have a deep basis. It's more like entertainment for a lot of people.
I think you're right about that. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the way, how could you possibly give two lines in a newspaper, you know, for each of 12 signs and that's it? And you're going to have a good day or a bad day. So, yeah, you're right. But there's probably something deeper to it. And we did have one scientist who's come to CPAC a couple different times. He's a physicist by the name of John Daring. Hmm. And he broke down this analogy I was talking about. He said, if there is a stellar influence that's affecting the Earth, and it's sort of stronger and when the solar system is at one point in space versus another point, he compared it to a car that's on a huge racetrack, you know, maybe hundreds of miles or so. And it's the driver has the radio turned on and he gets very poor reception when he's very far away from the broadcasting tower. And but now and then he passes by a rock or a cliff and it bounces the signal to him and it comes in kind of clear. And then he passes that point and it's low static again until his car gets you know, very close to the point where the broadcast station is. And at that point it almost doesn't matter what rocks or cliffs or things are around, because the signal is so strong that the radio comes in crystal clear. And John says that that's kind of how it is for us here on Earth, that there's something that affects us on a deep level that seems to enhance our abilities at when the Earth and solar system is at one point in space and diminish our abilities at another point. And, you know, he thinks it's a macro effect that has little tiny variations. And these variations you might call astrology.
Hmm. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's a nice analogy. He had all sorts of graphics for it and everything.
Now, the CPAC stands for the Conference of Procession and Ancient Knowledge, correct?
Right, yeah.
Okay, and you want to give people like a real simple rundown in case they don't understand what procession is and what the current scientific thinking on it is?
Sure. So from a layman's standpoint, we talked about the Earth spins on its axis, and you can see that motion in the stars, you know, the sun and all the stars rise in the east and set in the west. And it's not because they're moving so much, but because we're spinning, and it just makes them appear as if they're going around us. And then there's the second motion where we would see a different constellation overhead each month of the year. You know, very roughly, because the constellations don't take up exactly 30 degrees of sky. But when the Earth's gone around the sun a complete 360 degrees, you get back to the beginning constellation. Well, likewise, over this 24 to 26,000 year period, if you measure just by the date of the equinox, you might, you know, 4,000 years ago, we would have aligned on the spring equinox with the constellation Aries. That's the constellation that the sun was in on the spring equinox. And then the last couple thousand years, the sun has pretty much been in Pisces. You know, it's moved over roughly 30 degrees or so. And now the sun is getting very close to the constellation of Aquarius. And so, you know, sort of the, some people say that's the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
Right.
And so this is a real phenomena. You can observe the sun moving across the heavens, and that is, you know, precession. And, of course, scientists today have a very complicated explanation for that. And it was kind of born with Copernicus. Copernicus said, well, the sun doesn't move. Remember, he had to come along and explain the various motions of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And so he said, the Earth spins on its axis, the Earth goes around the sun, and the sun remains fixed. And so when he explained precession, why we see the sun move across the sky, he said the Earth must wobble. And, of course, Newton picked up on that and said, well, if the Earth does wobble, it's due to the gravity of the sun and the moon affecting the oblate Earth. And that's still the sort of the primary theory today. And, in fact, the sun and the moon does affect the Earth. It causes something called nutation. But we think the pull of the sun and the moon on the Earth really causes very little of the precessional effect, that in fact the sun does move across the heavens, that the whole solar system is moving through space. And so that's a quick explanation of the observable of precession, you know, the sun moving through these different constellations over very long periods of time, finally getting back to the beginning over 24,000 years. And that's a quick explanation of the modern view is that it's, you know, it must be this wobbling of the Earth, which is just a convoluted theory, by the way, versus the very ancient one, which we think has the most scientific merit to it, that in fact the whole solar system is moving at a very high rate of speed. And that will be re-acknowledged sometime in the not too distant future, I believe.
Okay. And your theory, one of your theories is that part of what's causing this precession is the orbit of our solar system around a center of gravity with another star, correct?
Correct, yes. So that would be, that would imply that the, that our solar system is part of a binary system.
Which is the rule, really, in the universe rather than the exception, isn't it?
That's right, Soraya, yeah. It's, you know, 100 years ago it was thought to be, you know, very rare that there'd be two stars that would be, you know, going around each other. And as telescopes got better and better, people started to realize, whoa, there's a lot of these out there. And so the latest surveys are about 60% of all sun-like stars. I think it's 63% is the latest survey I heard. Are in binary relationships. And if you count all stars, meaning not just yellow sun-like stars, but red dwarfs, brown dwarfs, etc., the number's close to 80% would be in either binary or multiple star relationships. Wow. So it does make you wonder, you know, are we really an unusual single star, or are we in a binary system and just really haven't realized it yet, if you will.
And mainstream science acknowledges that there's something else out there that has to be affecting the orbits of planets like Neptune and former planet Pluto and such like that, because there's things they can't explain about their orbits that would only be explained by another large body out somewhere outside of our immediate area.
That's part true and part challenged. And it seems to kind of wax and wane. And so, yes, when it was first, the outer planets were first discovered, it was just assumed that there's got to be a great big old giant 10th planet out there. And then they didn't find anything, and so it was assumed, no, there couldn't be. And then they have found some large dwarf planets out beyond Pluto in the Kuiper Belt. And so now a lot of scientists are going back to the view that there very well could be a large mass out there. And there's a couple of guys that are really intent on this, very, very good astronomer, astrophysicist, by the way. Mike Brown at Caltech is probably leading the charge. he wrote this book. I think it's called How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming.
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, and because he found so many other large Pluto-like objects out there. And so he is he's looking for some other big mass or brown dwarf or something like that. And there's a couple other guys that are doing the same thing. So the jury's still out.
Okay, and one of the possibilities you suggest that I find really compelling is that it could be the star Sirius.
Yes, yes. So there are a few people that are saying, hey, maybe it's not this very dark, difficult to see star like a brown dwarf or a large planet-like mass that just is so cool, you know, it doesn't show up very well, or it's against the galactic background, the center of the galaxy, and therefore it's difficult to spot in all the noise. But maybe it's something that we've been looking at all the time and just haven't realized yet. And so the more study I do, the more I am in that camp. And there are a couple different candidates there, but I think Sirius is the most logical candidate, not only because the ancients seem to talk about this. The Egyptians called it Isis. The ancient Japanese Shinto religion actually calls it our second sun and points their temples at it. Some modern scientists have been studying Sirius, and there's just a lot of weird things about it that they give you some indication there may well be a gravitational connection between the star Sirius and our own solar system.
And the only thing that really makes people doubt that is the distance between the two.
Yeah, and even that is kind of because we have these fairly low assumptions about speed, acceleration. And so, yes, so Sirius is thought to be roughly 8.6 light years away, although, you know, there are some that would argue that a little bit. I'm not going to get into that whole mess. If it is 8.6 light years, that would mean that our system and Sirius would have to go around a common center of mass of, you know, roughly 6 light years away for us. And that would require us to be going about 430 kilometers a second. And while that is above, you know, current estimates of solar system speed, those estimates are all, you know, sort of compared to what? Everything right. else is moving out there. And so there's a lot of arguments about that. And there are some people like Reg Cahill, an astrophysicist out of, I think it's Flinders University in Australia. He's actually measures it relative to the cosmic microwave background, the CMB, and he comes up with a speed of 430 kilometers a second. So that could well be happening. And
now he is not someone who is looking at Sirius as a secondary star. He just did that all unconnected to any of this work.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't even think he's aware of that being a theory. As a matter of fact, most astrophysicists, astronomers aren't. You know, most of them really don't study precession at all.
They think they have it figured out, so why study it?
Yeah, but it's not out of arrogance or anything. It's just that, you know, I talk to these folks all the time, and, you know, one guy's studying plasma physics, another guy's studying black holes, another guy's studying, distant quasars and things like this, classical mechanics is thought to have been figured out back with Newton, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's true. Nobody studies classical mechanics anymore, and I think there's going to be a couple of surprises pop up here in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, so there's also a group, if I have the name right, it's called the Sirius Foundation?
Yes, out of Canada.
Yeah, and they've done some, they've actually discovered some pretty interesting things about the connection between our solar system, or at least the planet Earth, and Sirius, like the fact that it there's a when Sirius B moves around Sirius A, there's a connection to the Earth at the same time that affects our orbit or something?
Yeah. So they're one of these groups that, totally independent research, and most scientists wouldn't even have the time to do the experiment that they've done, but they basically set up a telescope, a fixed telescope, entirely stationary. It has a crosshairs in the lens, and they have it pointed at Sirius. And so the only thing that moves their telescope is the rotation of the Earth.
Hmm.
So as the Earth spins around each day, every roughly 23 hours and 56 minutes, a sidereal day, you get around to picking up Sirius in the crosshairs again. And so they've measured this and timed this and found out that there's some interesting things going on that they don't notice any precession relative to the star Sirius. And they also say that before Sirius B transited between Sirius A and the Earth's rotation seemed to slow down slightly for some period of time. And then as it crossed, the Earth's rotation seemed to speed up for some period of time, roughly 30 days before and 30 days after. And so they find that there is some sort of gravitational relationship, and yet it's occurring at a distance where you wouldn't expect any. Although, this star, Sirius B, that goes around Sirius A is a neutron star. It's the closest, this white, dense dwarf close near us in our local stellar neighborhood. And these are these super dense things. I think a teaspoon of this matter would weigh about 2 tons.
Wow.
4,000 pounds. And so there could well be something going on with the, the way this B goes around A. It has sort of a pendulum effect, and it's and there's gravity waves. That's what they believe. And, they've done a lot of work there, and it's just going to take, different scientific groups to come along and do the same thing and find the same results or similar results and write papers on it. And, these things take decades and decades. But
are they the only ones that have said that Sirius doesn't precess, or have there been others that say the same thing?
They're the only ones that I've heard talk about this.
Okay.
And what they're really measuring is the Earth's rotation relative to Sirius. So they would say that the Earth is not precessing relative to
Sirius.
Yeah, not wobbling relative to Sirius.
And that would be impossible if it was done because of the wobble of the Earth. It should precess,
yes,
according to everything. We should precess to everything out there.
Yes.
And didn't they also say that we're not precessing, we don't see it on like asteroids they've measured or Venus and things like that?
It's a really obscure area, but you basically use a sidereal system when you look at objects outside the solar system, and you use a tropical or solar system when you look at objects within the solar system. And so, the tropical or solar system does not account for precession, whereas a sidereal system does account for precession. As a matter of fact, the difference between the two is the value of precession. And of course, astronomers readily acknowledge this, but they would say, it's inconvenient to use a system with precession within the solar system, because everything has such a high rate of motion relative to the stars. Relative to the stars, Venus and Jupiter and Mars are just racing across the sky.
Right.
Jupiter will go around us once every 12 years versus the stars, you know, with precession would go around us once every 24,000 years. And so they say there's a logical reason for doing that. But you're right. The fact is the Holmans would say that what we call precession is not so much the Earth wobbling, but the entire solar system moving relative to the stars. And so it's very logical. It fits really well. And, you know, we've found that the math works just brilliantly and is much better for predicting changes in the rate of precession than the old Looney solar theory. As a matter of fact, the old Looney solar theory has about 4,000 inputs in it. They're continually tweaking it when they notice it's wrong every 10 or 20 years. And whereas we use, sort of a Keplerian formula, and I just bounced this off a very, very good astrophysicist mathematician. It was actually a fellow that won the Nobel Prize. And he says the math works perfect. He thinks it's brilliant, and he thinks other scientists should study it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it doesn't happen to be his area of expertise, but
he checked out on the math.
Yeah. He actually won his Nobel Prize in mathematics, economics, not in in astronomy, but he's excellent mathematician.
All right. We got to take a quick break. We'll be back in 45 seconds with Walter Cruttenton.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we're talking to Walter Cruttenton tonight, author of The Lost Star of Myth and Time. And Walter, do you ever have, when you go up to different physicists and scientists, do they ever just kind of dismiss you out of hand?
Yeah, I'd say there's some. They're definitely, you know, they just think it can't be so. And so it's not like they've studied the material, but they just say it can't be. You know, somebody would have figured this out a long time ago. And so that's some group. But others that, you know, if I'm not in their face, for example, I went to the AGU, the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco, and presented a paper on it. And I didn't mention anything about a companion star. I just mentioned that there's a better explanation for precession and showed all the details and all the math and the studies and everything, and had a big poster just like the other 10,000 people around me had posters. And people came by, you know, all day long and said, makes a lot of sense, you know, and then they'd go on to the next poster. But, you know, we're all studying something different, and so nobody really looks at it deep enough to have it change anything.
Okay. I know you're aware of the electric universe theory. Do you think there could be an explanation in there to explain our connection between something as far away as Sirius as well?
You know, there could be. You start to get into different explanations beyond gravity, and I'm already far enough out on the limb. I don't need to go any farther out right now. So it could well be that, you know, it requires a better understanding of the subtle forces in the universe to explain this. But that'll have to be somebody else in the future that puts that piece on it.
All right. Well, let's talk about the actual cycles of the ages and what they mean according to ancient cultures. Now, the Greeks, as you said, had the main four cycle. That's what you named your documentary after, the Great Year.
Right.
And so what is the common accepted idea of these different eras?
Okay, this is really cool stuff. So from our present point of view, the Greeks broken into these four ages, iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. And each metal there, if you will, is sort of indicative of some of the qualities of that age. And the Iron Age is the material age. You know, man's consciousness is a little on the dull side. He perceives the universe strictly through his five senses. He has no knowledge of finer forces. In the Dark Age, he has no knowledge of molecules, no knowledge of atoms or electrons or neutrons or protons or magnetism or electricity or, you know, anything, any of the discoveries of the Renaissance. And then in the Bronze Age, which the Greeks also called the Age of the Hero, man starts to become aware of these finer forces. And sure enough, you know, Sri Yukteswar puts the change from the material age to this next yuga, the electrical age. He calls it the Drupara Yuga, around 1700. And you see the Renaissance is just really taken off a few hundred years before that. There's tremendous progress a few hundred years after that. And now a knowledge of these finer forces is common, you know, in that it's how our machines run. It's how you and I are talking right now over Skype, thousands of miles away. We think nothing of it. And yet this would have been considered black magic, you know, 400 or 500 years ago. And so then the next age would be the Treta Yuga or the Silver Age. It's supposed to be an age of a mental age. Greeks also called it the age of the demigods, when mankind's consciousness is getting so high that he begins to realize that he's something much more than this physical body and these finer forces. And it's easy to understand the ages below us because our consciousness is, you know, greater than that. So we can all understand the Dark Age. It's right. Almost impossible for us to understand an age above us, you know, because the cup cannot hold the ocean, if you will. And so when we read myth and folklore about this higher age, you know, it's a pre-Babylon age. It's an age when mankind lived in tune with nature, could commune with animals, and you know, telepathy, clairvoyance, or common knowledge, according to the yogis. And you know, it's something that seems very far out right now, but is supposed to be just as normal as these electronics are for us right now, in a higher time. And then there's the Golden Age, also called the Satya Yuga by the Indian culture. And that's even more incomprehensible. It's consciousness is sort of reached its zenith on the planet Earth, very clear. Mankind doesn't even perceive themselves as a physical body, except as a vehicle. And, you know, you're, I guess I don't have words to explain it. It's just right. A lot of myth and folklore, which often seems like gibberish to us, but, you know, there's lots of gods doing amazing, wonderful things, and so we just assume it can't be real.
Right, right. And would someplace like Göbekli Tepe fall in that golden age?
Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, so the work of Dr. Robert Schock and others, you know, shows how amazing this site in Turkey is, Göbekli Tepe. And it dates to about 11,500, 12,000 years ago. So, yeah, you're back close to the zenith of the last golden age. And, you know, this site was purposely buried. It's had it not been buried, we wouldn't even know it exists because it's, you know, much older than Stonehenge or the pyramids, which are much more massive stones. And, you know, many of those stones are just almost withered to smithereens. Mm-hmm. And so these fine bas-reliefs and things on these Göbekli Tepe stones would have been disappeared, and they're, even the pillars themselves would have just been shards by now. So yeah, that's amazing sight, and it's some sort of technology relative to a higher age that we don't know what its purpose is.
Well, Andrew Collins has been trying to decode the things on the site, and has said it has a very spiritual purpose. It doesn't seem to be technological, but very oriented towards the idea of souls and reincarnation and such.
Yeah, could well be. I mean, if the Golden Age is a spiritual age, the age of the gods, then our whole vernacular to understand it, it doesn't even exist, because, you know, we're not talking in spiritual terms right now. We're just, right. You know, we have these vague concepts of what that might be, but we don't live and breathe it.
And the Sphinx dates, according to Robert Schock and John Anthony West, back to about the same point.
Yeah, I would say that's more controversial. Schock definitely puts the Sphinx, you know, much older than other scientists did. But I would like to point out that, you know, Schock has been kind of venerated here to some degree, because remember when he first said that the Sphinx was much older than the rest of the Giza Plateau, he was just raked through the coals by academia, and, you know, who said, hey, if it's older, then show us some prior culture. And of course there was a deafening silence, and so they said, see, Schock, it can't be older, because we don't find anything older, and it's got to all come from something. And then, of course, almost 20 years goes by, and then they find Göbekli Tepe, which is not only older than traditional Egypt, but it's about three times older. Yeah, it's amazing.
Now, there have been also a lot of what are considered out-of-place artifacts discovered all over the world, some more convincing than others. For instance, the Antikythera device, which has a very definite date in which it was found, and is very definitely above the technology of the time. And if any other devices like that existed, they probably were either torn apart or lost to time. But this one just happened to be found on a shipwreck. Do you think there's a lot of stuff out there like that that maybe survived down to the lower ages?
You know, I doubt that very much of it really survived. I had a buddy of mine. We were talking about Coke bottles. I live here in Southern California, and, you know, Coke was made in these thick green bottles when I was growing up, and they were ubiquitous. They were everywhere, and I've done a number of these beach cleanup projects where we, you know, if a big tide's come in and sort of ripped up the sand, you know, it sometimes exposes trash. And we look and we look and we look, and we've never found any of these Coke bottles. And, you know, there must have been like a billion of them made, something like that. And so if something as recent as that and as ubiquitous as that is so hard to find, I think it's going to be very difficult to find things that might have had, you know, some great value a long, long time ago, because they were hoarded or hidden or lost or, you know, destroyed because for fear of falling into the wrong hands. But I'm sure we'll find things now and then, and there's probably some things we find we don't even realize what they are.
Oh, sure. Well, they found the Antikythera device back in what, 1908?
Yeah, and it took almost 50 years before they realized it was a complex geared device, and then another 20 years to build a replica and realize how sophisticated it is.
Yeah, right down to small details of motions of like the moon and stuff.
Yeah, it's a computer for the planets, and highly detailed, and the motions of the moon are exceptional. which, you know, nobody, that was so far before Copernicus that that thing was made. They don't know the exact date, of course, but it's at least 2,000 years old.
Right. And yeah, and it could be much older for all we know.
Yeah. You know, and there's some other discoveries like this one, Terra Preta do Indio in South America, which is this rich black soil that the Indians come across, and they get very excited because they know that they can grow papaya and other cash crops in it very rapidly because this soil is so rich. It's like a yogurt type soil. And it's been studied by Cornell, and, you know, I think per cubic centimeter it has like 5 billion living organisms. It's like yogurt. And as long as you don't take too much away, it'll just kind of sustain itself. And Cornell's been trying for 20 years to figure out how to recreate it with no luck. And so here's a technology that we know it has this wonderful purpose. We know that it dates back several thousand years because of the pottery shards and things that they found relative in it. And yet we still don't know how to recreate it in this modern age.
No, and it's not a natural thing by any chance.
No, it's found in definite square plots. And, you know, they found hundreds of them, I think thousands of them by now. And they tend to be, you know, where there were ancient civilizations. But we don't know how to recreate it.
And there's also things like the Baghdad Battery, which I believe your friend Jason Martell has recreated.
Yeah, he did. He brought one of those to the last CPAC, a matter of fact, and demonstrated, which is interesting. You know, he had the Baghdad Battery and one of these Egyptian light bulbs, a recreation. And you know, it worked, and yet when we look back on those times, there's very other little evidence of electricity. So you kind of wonder what they're using these things for.
Yeah, well, wasn't one of the theories that they were using it to plate gold?
Oh, to plate jewelry and things like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Did I?
You there? Oh, I think we might have lost Walter for a moment. He just kind of disappeared. Ah, we lost our internet for the moment. All right, well, we'll be back with Walter in a moment. And next week, actually, on the show, we are going to be having a man named Rabbi Gershon Winkler. And he is obviously a rabbi, but he will be talking about Jewish mysticism and things of that sort. Are you there, Walter?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I don't know what happened right there. We were talking about plating jewelry with these electrical devices.
Yes, so they think that might have been what it was for. I mean, it's one theory, but, you know, nobody really knows.
Right, right. Now, Jason is also a big proponent of the ancient astronaut theory. Do you think that that plays any part in the cycle of the ages? Do you think there's any evidence to support a connection there?
I don't know. You know, it seems to me that, you know, the universe is a pretty big place, you know, probably trillions of stars, and that means trillions of planets. And so I'm sure there's other life forms out there. It just seems logical. And yet we're not aware of them right now, so it's hard to comment. And so,
right.
I mean, if they... You know,
well, if we're moving on a definite cycle over and over, maybe we're coming closer to someone else's planet here and there.
It could be, and it could well be that you know, there's life forms that that we don't recognize right now. I guess we're waiting for human-like things to come along in metal containers, and then we can believe it. You know, versus other things that may be going on all the time that we can't believe just because we can't even relate to or understand.
Right, which is a theory that people like Jacques Vallée, John Keel, Andrew Collins also have come across for the UFO phenomenon, that they're not physical ETs, but maybe something from another dimension or another realm of being that we can't fully comprehend or sense in a way that we can easily describe.
Right. Yeah, it might be more like, you know, some of the saints and sages. You read these stories about some of these yogis and, you know, could well be more of that type of motion. Who knows? It's not my area of expertise.
And the Dogons also were connected, you know, venerated Sirius as well, obviously. And they said their ancestors had a connection to Sirius. I've heard people say they came from Sirius, but when I talked to Laird Scranton, I believe he said it was just a connection to Sirius.
Yeah. Hey, Laird's going to be at our next CPAC, the one in 2014, Rancho Mirage. So, yeah, he's a great guy. And he's just written, I guess, his third or fourth book looking at the complex structure of these ancient languages. And he's definitely in the camp that... ancient cultures knew a lot more than we give them credit for. And, yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, I think it's his fourth on the Dogon, and then he did the one on Velikovsky as well.
Okay.
But, the Dogon are very interesting in that respect, that they also talk about Sirius so highly.
They do, yeah. And the Dogon culture's roots seem to stem... probably from ancient Egypt. That's difficult to trace, but Laird thinks that might be a possibility.
Yeah. Well, based on the language interpretations for the most part.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, do you think during the Golden Age there may have been one worldwide culture that fell apart as we entered Dark Ages, and that's why this knowledge is all similar on so many different cultures?
You know, if we're getting to the point just right now, you know, we're barely out of the Dark Ages, and yet we seem to be able to travel all over the world and communicate with people. I got to think it's even easier in 500, 1,000 years, not to mention 5 or 10,000 years.
Right.
So... yeah, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means everything's the same and vanilla, or whether or not you know, people are really living in tune with their local environment much more than they are right now. And therefore, you do have these beautiful, wonderful, you know, ecosystems of diversity. Who really knows?
Okay. Now... What other, do you have any other guests confirmed for CPAC this next year?
So we'll probably have Shock and Daring and Laird Scranton. I think those are the three I've talked to so far. Stephen Knapp has said it probably looks good. So he writes a lot about the ancient Indian culture and it's how advanced it was. And so that's kind of our focus is to get these experts in the knowledge of very ancient cultures, and we're going to try to look at the similarities between some of the very ancient cultures.
Nice. Now, do you offer up these conferences online after the fact, or a DVD or anything like that?
Yeah, we have a group that comes and films them, and then they produce the DVDs. And they put them on their website, and I think you can get to those through our website, the Binary Research Institute, or you can probably simply Google CPAC, you know, CPAC talks, and find something there.
I know there are some abbreviated clips on YouTube.
Yeah, but I know I've got copies of all the full discs. And there is a fellow with a site. I think it might be called VW Tapes.
Hmm. Okay. What's since you've written the book, what's the most astounding thing you've discovered?
You know, I think it's no one thing. I think it's just a general confirmation. I try to Google keywords, keep these running searches going on, you know, ancient discoveries, ancient technology, things like this. And you know, I had dozens of examples in the first book, and since that time I've come across just hundreds of examples where things are out of place. And it might be, you know, orthodontics. Those are things that we thought were developed in the last few hundred years, and yet you find Egyptian mummies, you know, that go back thousands of years that have these things. Or prosthetic devices. You know, we thought that's something just developed since the Dark Ages. No, they go back, again, thousands of years. Brain surgery, dentistry, you know, these things, those 13 skulls they found in Pakistan, 8,000 years old, have neatly drilled rear molars. You know,
which shouldn't have been possible back then.
Right. It's just completely incongruent with our present paradigm. And there's so many of these that it makes me, you know, it makes me rather convinced that our current paradigm is wrong.
Right, right. And we're in kind of the minority in ancient cultures. They all have this cyclic idea. We have a linear one.
Yeah.
But yeah, do you have any thoughts on, like, the elongated skulls and things like that?
No, I really don't. Okay. You know, what fascinates me probably the most is the number of megalithic discoveries. And there's probably more than 10,000, you know, that they're either circles, these cairns, henges, dolmens, things like this. There was a massive use of very heavy stones that took place between, you know, 3,000 and 4,000 years, going back to 12,000 years ago. And even though it was easier to build with small stones or wood or, you know, many other objects. And so I think it serves some purpose that we haven't yet discovered. And so that's what fascinates me at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, I know there are some people that think that they are, I believe Rand Flamath actually came up with the idea that they are actually markers to see if the Earth is moving in any unusual way by marking the stars in the sky. Do you think there is a cycle of catastrophe that go along with these great cycles, or do you think that's more of a randomized event?
Oh, I think stuff happens now and then. I don't know that it's, you know, that it's really regular or predictable. But, you know, we know that meteors have hit the Earth, comets have hit the Earth, that there's great solar outbursts from time to time. Stuff happens, you know, it changes. You see a lot of different climate cycles looking, you know, in long periods of geological records and things like this. So stuff definitely happens, and I think some of it, you know, plays havoc with civilization.
Right.
Although it takes place on such long epochs that, you know, we tend not to notice it, as long as our predecessors' generations, going back a few generations, have been okay, then we're okay, you know.
All right. You're on WVBR-FM Ithaca. We're finishing up here with Walter Cruttenton on Where Did the Road Go? And I just had a question. It just left my head. You want to give people your website?
Sure. The main one is binaryresearchinstitute.org. And you can just go to that, find our research. And then as we get closer to the conference, we'll have CPAC.com will be up.
Okay. King's List. That's what I wanted to ask you about. The King's List in Egypt and Sumeria, and how the ages of these kings seem to get greater as we go back in time. And there is some mythology connected to the cycle of ages that also connects to that, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. It, you know, just as lifespans have increased markedly over the last couple hundred years, you know, going from roughly 40 years, 50 years old, 200-300 years ago, to, you know, 70, 80 years old nowadays. So are there common myths around the world of people that lived to be very old. I mean, the Bible, you see Seth and Methuselah and people like this. But it happens in Chinese dynastic records, the king's lists in Egypt, the Persian list of cultures. The farther back you go, the longer these dynasties and cultures and kings are lasting. And the closer you get to the Dark Ages, the shorter everyone is living. And now it seems to be increasing again. So I think it goes with this cycle and in some rough proportion.
Okay. And the speed of precession is also changing, isn't it?
It sure is, yeah. This is something that, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of, but it's... To have a 24,000 year cycle, you'd have to move about 54 arc seconds per year. That at 54 times 24,000, you get 360 degrees. But it was shorter 100 years ago. We have very good records for that. It was shorter 200 years before that, I mean the annual rate. And so the annual rate has clearly been speeding up. This is something that more and more scientists accept. And this is would be indicative if precession is indeed due to a body in motion in a, you know, in some sort of gravitational relationship. And so we think the precession has all the telltale signs of of a binary system.
Okay. How many times has this cycle repeated, do you think, for people to be able to recognize it?
I guess we have a dark age every time, and so we forget it. But there are some Indian writings that suggest it's just gone on and on and on and on, And so that's why they have these even bigger cycles that they account for.
Well, I know Michael Cremo is one of the people who takes some of those Indian legends and has tried to prove them scientifically, which trying to date modern human date back, you know, millions of years.
Right. So if exposed rock lasts barely 5 or 10,000 years, and this one yuga cycle is 24,000 years, it's tough enough to find evidence. So if you now start talking about millions and millions of year cycles, it just seems fruitless to me.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, people can get your book at the website?
Or on Amazon.com. Yeah, Lost Star of Myth and Time at Amazon. And check out the new one, too, the kids' book, The Great Year Adventures with Tommy the Time Traveling Turtle. He comes back from the future to tell us how the solar system works and describe the different ages.
And are you planning on writing anything else?
You know, I'm always working on a few things, but no rush, just, you know, keeping up the research and having fun.
Okay, and your documentary is also available?
It is, yeah. That's called The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones, and that too is available on Amazon.
Now, how did you get James Earl Jones in on that?
I just phoned him up and asked him if he had some time, and he said he would, and he really liked the material, and so he was very reasonable for us.
Very nice, very nice. Okay, so I thank you, Walter, for spending some time with us here.
And Soraya, it's a pleasure being on the show, and keep up the good work.
All right, well, thank you, and again, your website that people can find everything on?
BinaryResearchInstitute.org.
All right. Next week on Where'd the Road Go, we have Rabbi Gershon Winkler, as I said a few minutes ago. We'll be talking about Jewish mysticism and history and shamanism. The week after that, hopefully, we will have Andrew Collins to talk about his book Light Quest on the UFO phenomena, as well as discoveries at Göbekli Tepe. And you can always go to www.wheredidtheroadgo.com for information on upcoming shows, past shows, and everything else. And we will see you next week. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? We hear you loud and clear. Beginning our conversion of the signal here. 233, 377, 610, 987. Whence came this song? Foreign and familiar. I sighed here to the sky. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world.
The whirring of the world.
Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world.
The whirring of the world.
Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. To be wary, you are getting to the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atria, chambers numbered 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you-